Hello, you're very welcome to Near FM. To the listeners who are expecting the usual Northside today, you'll have it, but it will be afternoon. Today we are starting our current affairs programming with an special panel discussion in which we are going to be looking to the state of the European Union. Because we are going to try to avoid Brexit, although it's not that easy to avoid it because it's the theme in Europe at the moment. But some aspects of Brexit are in some ways an expression of a new brand of xenophobic populism that have actually big winning elections, initially in Hungary and in Poland. And now it's kind of moving westward towards France, the Netherlands, and obviously we can talk about what happened also in Britain, in the UK with that Brexit referendum. In the past 10 years, new right-wing political movements have brought together coalitions of neo-Nazis to mainstream politics. They have created alliance with mainstream free market conservatives, and this has created a normalization of political ideologies that in the past, really, they would have been dismissed as fascism or neo-Nazism. Elections results across 22 European countries reveals that support for populist radical right parties is higher than it has been at any time over the past 30 years. In countries like Finland, Austria, Poland and Hungary, these neo-fascists are already in power, and where they are not, they are shaping the policies of conservative governments and attempting to restructure education, immigration and the judiciary in their own illiberal image, rejecting principles and values that are at the core of the European Union and in some way may even threaten the future of the European institutions. Today in the studio, we have a panel of guests that will discuss this matter, and apologies for my voice. And the matter is, what is the future of the European Union against this background of increasing anti-European sentiment among the parties in government in Europe, and how this might affect not yet the European Union, but the rights of citizens, and we're using the word citizen, I'm referring to everyone who's living in the European Union, independently of the legal status. To do that, I have a panel of guests here with me in the studio, Shane O'Curry, who is the director of NR Ireland, which is the European Network Against Racism. And NR is part of a broader European network. The Irish branch is based here in Dublin. And they work with, it's a network of anti-racist NGOs, grassroots organizations and community groups. And it works collectively to highlight and address the issue of racism in Ireland, including through the promotion and monitoring of EU and global anti-racist initiatives. Hannah Desi, who is also sitting here with us, is a communication director with the Institute of International and European Affairs. She leads the public engagement for the future of the EU 27 project. And she has been working with Irish and European politics and advocacy for 8 years. For 5 years, Hannah worked in Brussels for the president of the Party of European Socialists and Social Democrats. And last but not least, we have Labour Party Senator Eoghan O'Riordan, who is on the phone. He was elected to the Senate on the Industrial and Commercial Panel in April 2016. So thank you very much for giving us the time and for coming together to talk about the European Union. I'm going to start with a question, a very direct question. And is maybe I will start with Owen. With Aon, because he's on the phone and we tend to forget the guests that are on the phone. So my question is, do you think the European institutions and the European Union can really survive this increased opposition by national governments to establish agreements to the institutions because of the anti-European policies that are supported by the new parties that are coming into power?
Well, I think the European institutions have to survive because there is no other way forward. I mean, clearly the European project is under more strain now than ever before. Part of that is somewhat of its own making in the way that it has maybe reflected itself upon the wider European community, the way that it has advocated for itself. Maybe there had been in the past a slight bit of complacency that people would always remember the reasons as to why it was founded. As we all know, it came out of the ashes of the Second World War, but that doesn't live long in the memories of younger people. And then when the financial crisis hit, it was very easy for people to try and gain political advantage by blaming faceless bureaucrats, etc. And even before that, I mean, I think Ireland, I think, needs to reevaluate how we promote the European projects. We would often, the political system here, give a sense of us gaining things from Europe. I have an image in my head of Albert Reynolds coming down the steps of an airplane in Dublin Airport talking about the billions that he had just got from Europe, as opposed to us being an integral part of the entire European project. But also in terms of individual projects that would have been, we would have benefited from European monies and around the country can often be passed off as being governmental projects. The wider benefits of the European project for Ireland and for Irish workers in terms of workers' rights, in terms of gender equality, in terms of LGBT equality, there's so many things that Ireland has and the wider European citizenry have benefited from the European project. I think there has been a level of underselling of that. And so when the financial crisis hit, there was a sense that there was there wasn't a level of equality as to how that issue was dealt with. And then when the migration crisis hit, it was just open season for those who had already been slightly disappointed by the reaction of the European institutions to the financial crisis. And then that faith that had been rocked was now exploited by elements of the far right to blame those same institutions for the migration crisis. And but your question is, can it survive? My answer is that it has to survive. There is no other option, but it will take people of centrist viewpoints, a centre-left viewpoint, even a centre-right viewpoint, to again and again and again restate the positives of collectivism, of working together, of solidarity, of internationalism, because this rise of the right has been coming for quite a long time. It's not something that we can necessarily be surprised by, but also it would be a mistake, in my view, to assume that anybody who votes for Brexit or anybody who votes for a far-right party has to be dismissed immediately as some kind of an unthinking racist. We can't allow ourselves to do that, but we have to understand are the reasons as to why people would vote this way, would feel this way, and then that is a challenge for us to respond to that and not to dismiss us. And I think that is the great challenge, not just in Europe, but in America, obviously, as well.
Okay. Interesting approach. That concept that really we have anti-European parties in government, and even those who are supposed to be supporting the European Union, actually they use it maybe in a not very positive light in the country. Hannah, what do you have to say to that? Is the European Union maybe something that is being used by the governments to blame it for all their bad decision policies, for the crisis that are national and where the national governments also have a responsibility?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what Aon is referring to is a trend that we have observed across the European Union and all member states. Perhaps less so in some of the newer member states in and around the time of when they joined, but certainly in the more recent past, it's very easy to go to a European Council meeting, come back with a decision that is, claim it as a success when it's something positive for your country, but blame Brussels when it's something that may be more negative. But I largely agree with a lot of Aon's points, but one thing that I would say is that the EU is very much the sum of its parts. And the reflection of EU decisions is very much based on who is elected across European member states. And I think that the faceless bureaucrats narrative has been particularly damaging because it's been a very strong narrative over the past 10, 15, if not longer, years. And it implies that there is no democratic oversight whatsoever. And the development of the European Union for many years had a very complicated relationship with democracy, but certainly from the time in which the southern countries transitioned from dictatorships into democracies and became members of the European Union, the EU's role in supporting democracy has become stronger. And the idea that the European Council decisions aren't taken by people who are elected, they are heads of state and government, they are elected by people across the European Union, and they are in that room making decisions on the basis of a democratic mandate. Again, post-Lisbon Treaty, the European Parliament is a very strong institution that is a directly elected institution, and national parliaments have increased strength and powers. So there are many democratic checks now at work within the EU, and we often don't actually talk about those, and instead we focus on these unelected faceless bureaucrats who actually, you know, make proposals but don't make decisions.
Mm-hmm. And particularly, I suppose that you are saying the checks are there. The governments, still the national governments, have reclaimed a lot of power. And we can see, for example, something that is happening at the moment that is in some ways they are even forcing the European Union to renegotiate existing agreements. For example, in the case of the refugee quotas. And very recently, the new Italian Home Minister, which is from Lega Nord, which is a very well-known xenophobic party. Mm-hmm. Not yet that they don't like migrants, is they don't even like Southern Italians, decided that we have that crisis with the boat carrying 600 refugees, and that the Italian government actually didn't allow to land in Italy, have to keep going all the way to Spain. So what's your take on this, Shane? I suppose, is the governments actually more stronger, and are they going to be shaping now European policy? Can't really the European Union, what it means to be in the European Union, survive when governments can pull out of agreements or force renegotiations?
Well, I think that's the tension to which Aon and Hannah were speaking. That I think the missing piece, if I can pull us back a little bit and talk about the vision of Europe. And you know, I remember growing up actually in France, two Irish parents, that I very much had a sense of my identity as a European, and I was very excited by this project that we were all part of, and this was part of building the peace. But very much a part of that was the consensus around the welfare state and around looking after everybody from cradle to grave who was within that, and that's how you solved conflicts and you ensured the good life for everybody, and tied up with that was the idea of progress and planned industrialization and really, you know, making the economy work at the service of people rather than trying to shape society for the needs of the economy. And I think that's a little bit what's happened in Europe, is that our crisis has been provoked by our slavishness to neoliberal economics and our creation of these forgotten zones of people. So those are the people to whom Aon speaks there, which is the people whose communities had been employed in industrial work, etc., who are now effectively, you know, a bit like the Rust Belt in America or wherever, who are now forgotten, and they are the people who see change around them, and whose anger at neoliberalism is deflected towards liberal elites. I think effectively by first of all the Jobbiks, but then later as those ideas become mainstreamed by the Fidesz and type parties, and you can see a similar thing happening in Britain, where you had UKIP but now you have, you know, Boris Johnson and company wearing UKIP's clothes. And so there's this kind of folding back in of far right ideas into mainstream conservatism. You know, don't forget that, you know, the EPP has these currents within it. So within the European, you know, within European political formations that were at the heart of driving the European project, we now have anti-European and anti-European elite sentiment, which is, I think, is toxic and something, you know, that we really need to guard against. I think what has happened in Italy is a, you know, a reflection of that, and also the fact of let's face it, we in Ireland and in other parts of Europe have failed in our duty to share responsibility for this humanitarian crisis, the so-called migrant crisis, that we, you know, we didn't roll up our sleeves and dig people out. And we left Italy and Greece and other countries at the front line. And we allowed for the conditions which allowed, you know, Fidesz in Hungary as well to say, you know, these liberal elites are imposing all these quotas on us. And, you know, we don't want to have anything to do with it. And we allowed all of that to collapse instead of really sharing a vision. And I think the key to it is to speak to and reassure those constituencies and to say we can have a vision which is a win-win vision for everybody. But we need to provide people with security and reinvigorate that cradle to grave vision, and there are ways of doing it, but it takes courage, and it means using the European Union, which is enormous, and it's something that's sizable enough to challenge international finance and corporate power, and to bring it to heel a little bit, to say, look, no, the economy needs to work at the service of people, and we have to stop engineering society to fit the needs of the economy, because this is what's bringing about this crisis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you have been talking actually now about migration and, mm-hmm. you know, the refugees. I suppose there is other aspect. Also, is the normalization of the treatment that asylum seekers mm-hmm. are receiving, people or migrants, people who are arriving to the borders of Europe, that they are being kept in terrible conditions in refugee camps, just on the limits of the European Union, or even they are kept in countries where the human rights and basic security is not met by any standards. Like, for example, in Turkey, we have seen the causes, a lot of videos and reports mm-hmm. on the new slave trade in Libya. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, it seems that the European Union actions are not really to solve this problem, but actually to keep them away from their borders. Mm. They are okay as long as it's not happening within the European Union. In some ways, we all bear that responsibility for the people who are dying in the Mediterranean. And my question here is, precisely, the European Union was created with a kind of very humanitarian, if you want to call it, vision to stop war in Europe, once one of the main, objectives or aims. It was about, in some ways, it was idealistic when it started. But it seems to me that lack of compassion is one of the main problems at the moment within the European Union, not among maybe the citizens, but the policies of the European Union. So isn't that at the moment the biggest crisis in the European Union? Because if you look at the situation of asylum seekers even in Ireland, and I'm going back to you because you were, when you were minister, one of the areas that you tackled was the provision in Ireland. But many years after it was initiated, it's still being implemented. There hasn't been a solution to the situation of asylum seekers in Ireland. And because the situation here is so desperate, sometimes you look at what is happening in Greece and it's more acceptable. So can we talk a little bit about that, Aaron?
Yeah, I mean, I can. There's two separate things, I think, to talk about in terms of Ireland's response, in that on one level, there's something to be positive about it, that there isn't a mainstream far-right political entity in Ireland that has any sort of political support in our political narrative, in our election cycle. We don't have that. And there's never been a political party with any sort of mainstream support who have listed immigration as one of their main, policy election platforms, if you like. So I think that's something we should be relatively positive about. Now, we did have a very divisive and nasty referendum about citizenship, which the Labour Party opposed in 2004. In fact, it was the first time I ran for election, the local elections, and that was very, very divisive and unfortunate and completely unnecessary, and 78% of the Irish people backed that referendum. So I'm not saying we have a completely clean background, but when I was trying to do my work in the ministry that I had responsibility for, all the criticism and all the pressure that I got and we got was from a left-wing perspective, a more humanitarian perspective. There was nobody in the Oireachtas or in media or anywhere saying to me, we need to be stricter or we need to have tighter controls. So that was something that I felt was good about our political system. In terms of direct provision, I've been criticised for not doing more. We produced a report after 15 years of a system. It took about 9 months to get the report together. A lot of NGOs, one NGO wouldn't sign off on the report. Everybody else did. And they signed off on it on the basis that it was a compromise between government and what they wanted. It wasn't ideal, but if they got everything passed or everything implemented from the report, they could stand over it as at least progressing the situation from where it was. What is deeply disappointing for me was that it wasn't completely and utterly implemented as a matter of priority for government. In fact, when the programme for government was being written, the draft programme for government had a commitment to implement that report, and then when the actual programme for government came out a week later, that commitment had been dropped. Now, a lot of things happened simultaneously. Obviously, there was a housing crisis, and we had the Mediterranean situation, and there was a responsibility there to accept in refugees from that situation. I do get the sense, though, from an institutional point of view, that the Department of Justice is completely ill-equipped to deal with migration issues, to deal with refugee issues, to deal with asylum issues, because they come from a security mindset, they have a law and order mindset. They don't look at this issue as being one from a humanitarian background or humanitarian outlook. So I would feel, from my interaction with the Department of Justice as a minister in there dealing with this issue, that they come at it from a very unsympathetic point of view. They come at it as saying, well, if we do this, it'll raise a flag and we'll have more of these issues and more of these, what they will consider to be a problem. So I think in the future, and a future government needs to look at taking that entire section out of the Department of Justice. We as a country, have an opportunity now, given our history and given the fact that Irish people are all over the world, to speak differently about the immigrant experience. Many people would say that we have fallen short on a domestic basis on that. I would tend to agree with that. We have asked the Americans to regularise undocumented workers in the States who are Irish, that we won't do the same here for many different reasons. But I would be hopeful that a lot of the far-right rhetoric across Europe wouldn't get much traction here in Ireland. But then again, we can't be complacent about that.
Shane, Hannah, do you want to comment?
I suppose just really thinking in and around the rise of, I think it's a very problematic conversation, just thinking about the European Union rather than just the Irish point of view, the way we have to constantly talk in the same breath about the rise of nationalism and the increase rise in migration. And it's necessarily problematic because we're leading to a zero-sum game, and we're persistently, there's a lot of dog whistle terminology used in European Union politics now. And for me, the most troublesome expression of all of this a few years ago was when Donald Tusk stood up the summer of, the massive, I say in speech marks, rise in migration, and made a speech where he said, please don't come to Europe, you're not welcome. And, harking back to what Shane was talking about, this idea of the European Union as a political construct that brings everybody together and builds a more socially coherent and cohesive society. I find that to be deeply tested when the President of the European Council says, you are not welcome to come to Europe. And I thought that that time was really, really troubling indication of these mainstream attitudes legitimizing far-right and xenophobic politics. And it's worrying in that I think that it questions the EU's very reason for being in the same way that now the EU is trying to deal with infringements on the rule of law in Hungary and Poland. And I think that these very existential moral crises that the EU is now trying to navigate beset it with deep weaknesses and fundamentally fragment the strength of the European Union project.
Shane, I'm going back to you now, but I just heard that Erdogan may need to leave us now, so I want to give him a chance. There is any final comment, Erdogan?
Yeah, I go back to what Shane had to say at the beginning. I mean, I think far too much of the discussion about the European project for the last 30 years or so has been around economics. It's been about trade. It's been about, you know, the establishment of the euro, and that's all very well. But and that's important to a degree. But what Shane has said at the beginning is that these need to be working for people. That the fundamental reason for the existence of the European Union has to be to benefit the citizenry, has to be to benefit the individual, has to be about an uplifting of the human condition, of human rights internationally, and that has been lost. How it's been lost has to be examined. But when we face into European elections now next year, we would hope that we can elevate the discussion about the importance of the European Union, not just what we can get out of it as a country or what an individual candidate wants to try and squeeze out of the European project for his or her constituency, but the fact that this, you know, the humanity of the project has to be reborn. The that ethic needs to be reimagined, and to stop always talking in terms of pound shilling and pence and trade and economics, because people are wounded. I think people are wounded right across Europe. They're justifiably worn. They're justifiably hurt. But I think there is a value to internationalism and to solidarity that can outseed this current crisis if people are brave enough to stand by it. It's far too easy for somebody of the left or the centre left to stay quiet when somebody is propagating far right ideology. And I find it deeply disappointing, for example, what the Labour Party are doing in Britain when they have a fantastic opportunity to stand up for something much more important. But they seem to be sucked into just accepting the Brexit reality and all that came in behind it. But look, I think we have to be positive. We have to defend these ideals and not be ashamed to promote them.
Okay, thank you very much, Erdogan Riordan.
No,
the best of luck.
Thank you
for joining us. Shane, your turn. A lack of humanity among politicians in this European Union.
I think the way the Eurozone is structured and the way the European Union institutions work and leave some people behind needs to be addressed. And I think that comes back to Aon's original point that we can't dismiss the UKIP voter, or we can't dismiss the person who votes for Fidesz or Jobbik out of hand, or the disenfranchised post-industrial French worker who had voted communist or socialist for generations, who are now voting for the National Front. Those people are hurting. There's the French saying a racist is somebody who is angry at the wrong thing. And the reason they're hurting is because, huge swathes of the European Union are not working for people, and people who had enjoyed security are no longer enjoying it. And that's happening to all of us. We all live in a gig economy. We're all increasingly precarious in our work, And it really incumbent on us to really grab the bull by the horns and say this needs to change, and it really needs a vision. And I would say starting with, the way the Eurozone. I think it's interesting that if you look at the Italian crisis is also. Italy's quite similar to Greece in terms of that it's on the periphery, and it's been made to pay the price for the low interest rates and within the Eurozone made to pay the price for the German need to keep exporting goods, right? That's the way the Eurozone has been structured. Now Ireland has managed to find a niche role in creating industrialization by invitation, and particularly targeting Silicon Valley and making ourselves into a portal for the English speaking industries. But that's not a game that everyone can play. That's Ireland doing Irish politicians and technocrats doing the smart thing and positioning us. But that's not a vision that we can sell. And I actually think that as Irish people, we should return to our original vision and as Aon says, our Irish nationalism and our vision of ourselves is largely one about, is a kind of civic republicanism. So where we don't pander to that type of xenophobic discourse. And in fact, like if you can go all the way back to the Confederation at Kilkenny in 1642, where it was said that a citizen was, could be Protestant, Catholic, yeah, even if his parents came from Hindustan. So, I mean, that's something that's been at the core of our sense of self here, which is something that I think is beautiful and needs to be celebrated. And Irish foreign policy in the initial years was, I think, extremely brave and courageous in that we positioned ourselves as anti-imperialists and as brokers on the sides of the new emerging nations in the international system, but you, at the same time using our skills as English speakers, which English being the lingua franca of international relations, and I would really, and then we have that tradition of solidarity and international aid and development and stuff, and I think that if we could harness that vision again and say look. We in Ireland have a vision for a type of civic, civic republic that we would like to replicate, not just in Ireland, but across the world. I mean, the fact of the matter is that Europe needs inward migration, right? We our economies desperately need them, right? All of us, all of them do. Ireland is going to need 40,000 workers in the ESRI just said it the other week that we're going to need 40,000 new workers in the coming years. What we need to do is to create institutions and create infrastructure and industries that address the hurts of the people who are forgotten, but also create pathways and ordered migration for people. At the same time as exporting our vision and challenging the belligerence and the fragility and insecurity of the type of politics that's been projected by the Donald Trumps of this world. I think that we, even though we're a small country, have a unique role to play in that. And the European Union can become a vehicle for something much, much more progressive in the world, in a world that's changing at an international level. Yeah.
Can I pick up on something you said earlier? You were talking about the disenfranchised people, the people who are hurting and are voting for these nationalist parties. I feel a bit using this kind of soft terminology to talk about what they really are. Yeah. But okay. But in some ways, isn't it that, for example, we have the cases of Poland and Hungary that I think are the more evident in the basis of the European Union. You have two parties there who got into power, with very strong anti-migrant policies and anti-European policies. Well, these two countries are the ones that get the smallest percentage of migration and refugees and asylum seekers that want to stay in those countries. So really, they didn't have a problem with migration at all. They didn't have. It's not that migration is a problem, but in their own perspective, they didn't even have the numbers for it to be noticeable. But they make a case against migration. And now we can see these countries are the ones that are implementing the most restrictive policies towards their own citizens. Okay, we have at the moment in Hungary, for example, if any human rights organizations or any NGO who is receiving funds from outside the European Union, they have to register as foreign agents, which actually stops them from getting any in national funding. The first legislation that Viktor Orban passed in Hungary was the new audiovisual legislation, that it was so restrictive that even at the time Barroso, who was the president of the European Commission, said that they will have to intervene. That was 10 years ago. Nothing has been done so far. We have now the Law and Order Party in Poland. It's called Law and Order. Law and Justice, sorry. Law and Order is much appropriated. I don't know where the justice term goes in this. But this, they have been targeted human rights groups, feminists, pro-immigration activists through media censorship. Then we have in both countries the new legislation around the Holocaust and the fact that they are saying that their citizens in the past didn't bear any responsibility towards the extermination, basically, of the Jewish population in their countries. So really, and all this is being allowed within the European Union. And what worries me is I remember the times when Turkey was applying to become a member of the European Union, and the European Union kept rejecting their approaches, saying that they will have to raise the human rights standards. But are we at the moment lowering our human rights standards by allowing this government actually to implement these policies that are against basic civil rights?
There's a really interesting quote that I heard about this recently from a former European Commission official who was saying that, you know, to join the European Union, you have to meet all of these criteria. But the mistake that was made post-enlargement was that there wasn't a maintenance of monitoring of meeting of the criteria post-membership, post-accession. So in order to join, you have to bring all of your institutions and your rule of law up to a certain level. But once you're a member, you're in, that's it. And not maintaining that maintenance is, I think, because we have a skewed conception of democracy as something that you achieve. And once you achieve it, that's it, you walk away. But in fact, democracy is a continually self-building and self-fulfilling process that we all have to contribute to democracy for it to actually be a functioning system that maintains the fundamental basic standards that we believe it that it can, and also to protect minorities and to be a pluralist democracy. You need to have active citizens. So by not continually monitoring the standards of democracy, we asked member states when they were in the accession process to come to post-accession. The European Union missed a trick. And probably, I think, because of complacency. When I worked in Brussels, I initially worked for a Danish politician for a number of years, and after a while I started working for a Bulgarian politician, and that was in 2011-2012. And his thought process in and around democracy was totally novel and totally different from anybody else in Brussels at that time, because for him it was a priority the same way regulation of financial elements of the system were. It was as an equal and important policy priority, the maintenance of democracy, because he came from a country where democracy was not a given. So I think that that's one fundamental aspect of it. The other is that, you know, the European Commission has instituted Article 7 proceedings against Poland. And I think that that is in an attempt to say, look, you know, there's been a serious breach of the rule of law. We need to address this. But the European Union is coming up against an issue in that any European Union change, agreement, policy, decision takes a long, long time. And the rhythm at which politics happens nowadays, partly due to technological change, is so much faster. And the rhythm at which we as citizens expect change to happen is so much faster than what a consensus-based group of 28, 27 member states can achieve, that there's a massive disconnect there in terms of delivery. And Timothy Garton-Ash, a British academic, has a quote about this recently. He gave a speech at the IIA in Dublin, and he said, the European Union are playing chess, but Poland are kickboxing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Hungary are kickboxing. So, you know, you're fundamentally at odds there in the way in which we're all manoeuvring. And how do you solve a problem happening in real time when your decision-making process is just not at the same pace?
Mm. Shane?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I mean, I think, again, so, you know, triggering Article 7 proceedings against Poland, and I think what you said it there when you're saying they're kickboxing, is there's a real danger that that is going to be grist to their xenophobic mm-hmm. mill, that their Eurosceptic thing, their rhetoric.
Can we maybe explain what Article 7 is? Because I think we are on the table now, but maybe the listeners don't have it.
Sorry, it's Article 7 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union, which allows the European Union to remove voting rights of a member state that is breaching the rule of law.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'll let you continue. I might actually have the exact wording in my bag.
Right. Okay. And I think that that's the danger. I mean, I think that the Law and Justice Party and Fidesz have positioned themselves as the defenders on very, and coming back to your question, Sally, defenders of those constituencies who have an emotional sense of insecurity, which is, you know, which is the result of deindustrialization and a result of the collapse of the economies of the former Soviet Union in their case, and who, even though they don't rub shoulders with migrants very much, are in some ways that's quite typical of your National Front voter or of your far right or your BNP voter, is that it's often not people who come from mixed neighbourhoods who vote for them, but the ones adjacent to them, because migrants are a strange other, rather than somebody who could be related to you or your neighbour or the person in the shop, etc. And I think Law and Justice and Fidesz are very good at capturing that sentiment and mobilising it, while at the same time still promoting neoliberal economic policies, which are the very policies which tear communities apart and leave people on the slag heap, if you like, and so they're very smart at doing that, and I think it's a real challenge, I think. But, you know, all of this, I think, is underpinned by the way the Eurozone is structured and the way that the Euro and membership of the Eurozone has very little to offer those countries. And so I think that the way out of this is a new deal for Europe, is that, you know, we need to be arguing for a Marshall Plan type across the board investment, which creates a society that everybody can buy into. I mean, I think that we need to give alternatives to the peripheral countries of Europe that don't force people into these games. So Ireland, you know, we've positioned ourselves in a unique way, and we now have an export-led economy again, and you know, we're enjoying growths. But that's not something that's worked for Italy, and it's not something that worked for Greece, and they're having their crisis, and in Hungary and Poland, it's playing itself out in the rise of the far right and authoritarianism. We need and again, it really is the enemy is neoliberalism. The enemy is that type of economics and the politics that flow from that, which manifests in different ways according to different conditions in different parts of Europe. And that is the thing. And I think part of one of the problems is that the left, from the social democratic left, even to the former communist parties, have been afraid in recent years to address the problem of economics. We've all bought into the Thatcherite, there is no alternative to neoliberalism, and it has brought us here. And I think that at this point, we need to start articulating a different vision for the economics. And a global politics will flow from that, you know. And at a European level, we can challenge global capital and international finance. It's no longer something that we can challenge at a national sovereign level. Mm-hmm. So it's something that we need the European Union, and you know, and as Eoin and Hannah said, we desperately need to maintain what we have of the European Union in terms of workers' rights, in terms of safety, in terms of women's rights, in terms of protecting minority and human rights, etc. But we need to extend beyond that and be bold, and that means challenging Germany and France, and challenging the core economies who are benefiting the most from the current structure, and saying no, actually we need to do this differently. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. Totally. Hannah, mm-hmm. you were going to tell us a little bit more. Did you find any more about Article 7?
I'm not going to read it out because I don't think that would be the most exciting thing to listen to right now. But essentially, Article 7 allows that if there's a serious breach by a member state of the values of the European Union as outlined in Article 2 in respect of the rule of law, and democracy is one of those, the voting rights of the representative of that government within the member state European Council's formation can be suspended. But the amount of time that it takes to get to that point,
it's a very long process. I was looking at some graphics yesterday, and very complex, and you need like three different institutions to approve it then.
It comes back to the issue of compromise and consensus-based system is never going to deliver clear outcomes in real time the way that we expect it now. But just on the broader points actually that Shane was raising, I think we'd be remiss to have this conversation not talk about the European elections, which are obviously in less than a year's time now, in May 2019. And the most alarming thing actually that I've read in the past year, I would say, was a small news piece yesterday that Steve Bannon is setting up a group based in Brussels that will be called The Movement, that will aim to bring together and unite far-right and xenophobic forces. And I think that that's deeply dangerous, and I think that all pro-European forces of the centre and of the left need to be extremely mindful of that, because the far right in the European Parliament has traditionally been totally beset by division and opposition, and finds it very hard to remain together ever for a length of a parliamentary term. However, we've seen what Steve Bannon's specific approach can yield, and I think that it, in terms of a very worrying development in advance of the European elections, that's extremely, extremely worrying and distressing, I would say. I think it's also a call to action. I think that anybody who believes in European solidarity really needs to take heed. Nonetheless, there were some very... The new Italian government, very, very concerning government, and were they to start to successfully ally to other xenophobic forces in advance, almost a year out for organising, that's quite a substantial amount of time, and it's very concerning. And there needs to be an alternative vision, an alternative vision that people can get behind and feel inspired by. And the European election, is traditionally an election that people don't necessarily pay that much attention to. And I do think it's incumbent on everybody to start talking about the European election now, as opposed to just 6 weeks before it, and talking about it as an opportunity for citizens to have their say and talk about the way in which they conceive the EU as a force for good, or how they think it could be better. And there is a Future of Europe process undergoing at the moment. In Ireland, the Department of Foreign Affairs has organised citizen dialogues around the country, but the European Commission started this process in 2017, 60 years on, around the anniversary of the Treaty of Rome. And, what they've tried to do with their white paper outlining different scenarios is say, citizens debate this. But that's very hard to do. There's been different models in different countries. Obviously, I said there were the ones here that DFA organised with the European Movement. The IAA has a Future of the EU 27 visitors speaking program, where we have ministers come in from different countries. And last week we had the Romanian Minister for European Affairs, and he's very interesting because he's organised their citizens dialogues, and he came to ministerial politics via being a grassroots activist in Romania, and he has gone for organising, he and his remaining colleagues have organised large-scale citizens' dialogues and debates. They've also gone for very small-scale ones called Speaking About Europe, where they bring together groups of 10 citizens in small towns. So everybody, you know, it's not limited to 10, but they tend to be very small ones. And it's really to get a proper two back and forth conversation going, where people really feel heard and listened to, and that they receive answers to complicated questions as opposed to just listened to but not quite sure where those answers go, what sort of report they get shelved into. And he was talking about that last week as a really positive way of engaging with citizens. And perhaps that model needs to be looked at across the European Union in the run-up to the elections as a way of truly engaging with people instead of allowing populist parties to manipulate people's fears, which is what they are doing by saying they speak for the people, the one voice of the people. You know, it is, quite frankly, a manipulation of people's fears for populist parties to do that.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that the I don't know if it's a word, the manipulability of people's anxiety is what those parties are mining, and they're mining it in the absence of meaningful engagement and participation in society in all kinds of, you know, in economic and social life, but also in terms of participations in the structures of power. There's a democratic deficit. You know, what we saw with the process of European integration was an integration of the economies and an integration of the political functions and the decision-making functions without necessarily there being an equivalent integration of civil society organisations and trade unions and citizen power and democracy. And what we have always needed is a deepening of democracy right down to a local level, like down to decision making in your neighbourhoods, but also in the workplace. And so we need, I think anything that allows us to elaborate a vision of a deeper democracy is the way we need to go. And that's the, you know, that is the answer. I mean, the answer to fascism is the opposite, right? Is that you deepen democracy and you address people's fears, and, you know, and it is not to pander to it. And, you know, so I'm a little bit worried that there's, you know, that there I read a newspaper report that there are sections of the German left who are tilting towards what they're calling a national social politics, which I really I find that extremely alarming.
I have heard that from my German friends.
But so, that is not the way we go. I mean, I'm also thinking about the British Labour Party's mugs, the infamous controls on immigration coffee mugs that they issued. That type of shameful, but xenophobic kite flying is something that we really need to root out, and it has no basis in reason at all, and it's purely opportunistic, and it's toxic. It really tears our societies apart. So I think that we do. I think that we all agree that it is in elaborating a vision of a different Europe. And of an inclusive one, and of taking some bold steps, but also of challenging vested interests, you know, that and recognizing that people's concerns and fears are, if they're misarticulated, it doesn't mean that there isn't something real behind them, and so, you know, building, you know, and, you know, addressing some of our other issues. So if we not being afraid to say things like we need to tax corporations more, we need to redistribute wealth, we need to think about radical programs such as, you know, as we're getting more and more automation and more internationalization of industrial processes, we need to think about guaranteed basic income and find ways of liberating people from welfare traps and the poverty trap, so that if they have, you know, if people have a guaranteed basic income, they're also entitled to work and they can also contribute back to the economy without looking over their shoulders and you know, fearing somebody's, and also the whole labelling of communities as welfare cheats, etc. We really need to address all of the things that make people feel unwanted, devalued, marginalized, and participants in society. And that way we won't get them angrily responding. And the best way for us, I mean, the Steve Bannon thing really makes my blood boil. But I think that the best way for us to do that is to double down on our efforts to develop a vision for a root and change vision of a relaunching of the European Union, like European Union 2.0.
Yeah. Yeah, in some ways I was thinking Russian interference in American elections and now American interference in European elections. It goes a full circle, isn't it? Well, we are running out of time, so we have to leave it here. I want to thank you very much. In some ways, I want to finish on a positive note. I think maybe the approach has been a bit bleak, but think of something. There is future. There is a lot of people in Europe that is working towards a better Europe, a more open, friendly, equal Europe. So let's keep doing that and voting for the right party at the general elections, please, and also at the European elections. So that's all for today. I want to thank my guests again, Sean O'Curry, who is the director of FENAR, Hannah Dizzi, the communication director with the Institute of International and European Affairs. Also, a Labour Party senator, Eodon of Jordan, who have to leave us early. And sadly, we couldn't get Owen O'Brien on the phone. He was busy, but maybe for the next time. And also Paul Lochran on sound, and our researchers, Glenn Caldwell and Cara McGeehan.
This special program was supported by Communicating Europe, a Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade Initiative.